Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections, and I'd like to welcome you to another edition of the Michigan Writers Series. This is our last event of the spring, but we're already hard at work on next year's Michigan Writers Series. Already committed is Diane Wachowski of the MSU English Department and Gary Gildner, who is an internationally recognized poet and essayist, who will be coming in the fall. Both Diane and Gary will be here in the fall. So I hope you'll be looking for publicity about the series for the coming year, and we're very excited to have you here this evening. Our guest tonight is Eleanor Benedict, who I'm very pleased to have here. Notice that Eleanor has brought some books of hers that she would be happy to sign after the reading. For those of you unfamiliar with the format of the Michigan Writers Series, the poet, the reader, reads for about 40 minutes or so, and then we open the floor up to questions, and then after that you can come up and ask for books to be signed and buy the books if you so desire. Eleanor Benedict, a native of Tennessee and graduate of Duke University, earned an MA in English from Wright State University, Ohio, and an MFA in writing from Vermont College. She has won several awards, including the Mademoiselle Fiction Award, a Michigan Creative Artist Award, and a National Writers Union Prize for Poetry. She is also winner of an editor's grant from the Coordinating Council of Literary Magazines as founding editor of Passages North Literary Magazine. She is winner of the 2000 Mae Swenson Poetry Award for her first collection, All That Divides Us, published by Utah State University Press. She has also published 5 chapbooks of poetry, the most recent of which is The Tree Between Us from March Street Press. She has lived in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan for 25 years. Please join me in welcoming Eleanor Benedict.
Thank you very much, Peter. Well, what is a person as old as I am doing with a first collection, you might ask? And sometimes it just takes a while to get a collection out. This book, I'm grateful to Maxine Kuhn for having picked it as prize winner for the Mae Swenson Award. Mae Swenson, if you don't know, well, she passed away in 1989. She was a Scandinavian-based, or at least her background was Scandinavian, and she did some translations of Thomas Tranströmer and other poems. I was delighted to see that she had written about Florida, which is where I have just come from, and don't all hit me at once. It is warmer down there than it is here. It's too warm. I'm glad to be up here in the spring. This book has a story to it, and rather than just tell it to you, I'll just say that for years as a child and then as a teenager and a college person, I was fascinated by this mysterious aunt that our family had, Aunt Grace. And I heard about her, but I didn't see her. We would get letters from China with interesting stamps on them, phoenix birds and pagodas, and then gifts would come in the mail. And I thought, who is this person? And every now and then my father or somebody in the family would say something like, oh, I wish Aunt Grace was here. And then my father would say to me, oh, you look just like my sister Grace. And there was in that tone of voice something there kind of heavy, and I didn't know whether I really liked that or not. Once I saw a picture of her, and she was kind of an old lady. I didn't want to look like an old lady. So she was a ghost in my early life. And as it happened later, as a college woman, I learned about the history of America and China and the relationships between the two countries. And at that time, I was at Duke, and it was in the 50s, right at the time of the Korean War. And the letters that we'd been getting from our aunt in China were getting very, very upsetting, because they were saying, this is a terrible war you're getting into. It's all your fault. You're fighting our people. You're fighting my new people. And it was quite upsetting, because also it was the time, as I say, of the McCarthy era. So anybody who was even writing to people from communist countries was rather suspicious. It made it even worse that my father had worked for defense industries during World War II. In fact, at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, developing the atomic bomb. So you can imagine what his feelings were about getting these letters and amid investigations of people who had been spies and so forth. But of course, in the 1970s, Nixon went to China and the relationships were opened up, and this letter came to our family in Chattanooga, Tennessee, saying, is anybody in my family still alive? And it was Aunt Grace, and she was making contact with her family. She did come back, and to make a long story short, well, I'll just read you the first part of one of the poems that begins the book. It's called A Letter to Myself on My Birthday. And my birthday is June the 4th, 1931. This is the day I was born. Summer in Tennessee, a long time ago, when people feared dust, debt, and that dry mouth feeling the voice over the radio's crackle called fear itself. In my mother's hot room, I lay naked and yelling when my father's sister came to say goodbye, holding a baby of her own, half Chinese, leaving with a man who changed her country, her mind. When I was older, I learned her story from snapshots, gifts from abroad, bits of gossip around the holiday table. I caught those glances between my father and my uncles, felt their red-faced silence. Lula, the cook, served the meal as if she didn't see. She took care of me, knew the family secrets. How surprised I was to learn she had two children of her own. When my mother drove Lula home downtown, two small boys, darker than their mother, ran up, then stared at me through the closed car window. Once when I wouldn't behave, Lula snapped, "Don't you act so bigoty, Miss Priss. Your aunt done married a Chinaman." There's more to that poem, but rather than tell you the whole story, I'll let you find out by yourselves. Aunt Grace married a Chinese man, as you just heard. He was an engineer who very much wanted to go back to China and, well, as this poem says, bring his country out of the dark. He had learned about sanitary engineering, and it was his dream to go back and modernize a lot of the towns and cities, big cities, in fact, where he lived, Tianjin, China. This little poem is in memory of Lu Fuqi and Grace Divine Lu. And when I first realized I would need this poem, and I don't usually sit down and just write them in cold blood, but this one I did, and I thought, what would a bridge to China look like if you were going to build one? And so this poem came out of that, A Bridge to China. No engineer could dream such arches, drape them over monstrous pylons, ask armies of iron workers to hurl enough highway across a planet already curved, tense with spilled rivers, heavy with salt. Yet one woman sailed across more than an ocean to join a man who dreamed his country out of the dark. Their lives spun silk over distances, wove legends of Xian's warriors and tales of Tennessee women, fine-tempered as steel. Now their families face each other across years of long water, pull tight between two continents, the invisible threads. So I met my cousins, and couldn't understand everything they said, but they did speak English pretty well. But when we first met, this little poem is from the first part also of this book. Meeting Our Chinese Cousins, and it has from it has in front of it an epigraph from the Bible. Every man heard them speak in his own tongue, and that's the thing about Pentecost, if you remember that holiday and that story, both in the Jewish religion and also in the Christian. Pressed into a bedroom of the Beijing Hotel, we are strangers and kin. We bow and hug and give each other gifts of sesame sweets and tinfoil chocolate. We take each other's pictures and compare faces. Everyone talks at once in two languages. But I am confined to a few words like an expensive jailbird. They feed me the necessary phrases bit by bit. When they hand me the key to my room, I go quietly. But all night long, I sleep with my eyes open, see hundreds of faces, listen for voices speaking in tongues. I went to China three times. The first time was to make this opening and this meeting with my cousins. That was in 1980, when things were really just opening up. It was quite different then from the way it is now. Have any of you been to China? Well, you have? Okay. The last time I went was 1995, and things had changed a great deal, partly westernization, I guess, is what I noticed. And tourism, the second time I went, was a kind of a study but touristic trip. And so the second section of this book has a lot about just tourism and in some cases the ugly American tourist. And I found so much in my own perception of China, how I had lots of stereotypes and kind of, without meaning to, was looking down my nose sometimes at these primitive folks. And I'm sorry to confess that, but as I wrote these poems, I realized, you know, I really had an attitude sometimes, even though I had known more about the Chinese history and our relationships. I followed it really closely. But still, this little one is called Bamboo. Off a back street courtyard, a gray room, flowers with bright brush plantings by elderly men and women who gather to meet us. They wear old Mao suits as if they have slept in them for years. They sit shyly while their leader demonstrates how to paint bamboo on silk. But we are tired. We have seen too much bamboo already. During the question period, we hardly ask anything. We walk around slowly, smiling at the walls, wondering what these people did before they got old. Worked in the silk mills, picked soybeans. One small woman shuffles up to me and points out her painting above us, a blood-red peony. She tells me she speaks a little English. I look for a suitable question to give her. What did you do before you retired? She bows her head as if receiving a blessing, answers, for China throughout seven provinces, I designed railroad stations. Also my design, this next picture of bamboo. You're afraid to ask leading questions, I think, when you're in universities and you're being lectured to about Chinese history, and someone always comes up and says, but what about Tiananmen Square? And the answer, well, this one is called The Truth About History, and there are two parts, but I'm just going to read the first one. It's called Where Were You? At Shandong University, a middle-aged professor wearing a pinstriped suit gives his lecture on modern Chinese history for foreign visitors. The room feels muffled as he details the May 4th movement, Mao's rise, the Japanese war, liberation. We nearly fall asleep, but we wake up when he reaches the Gang of Four, nearing that day we saw on television, Tiananmen Square. He stops before he gets there. We ask him why. He clears his throat, pronounces the incident too new to be history. Then he offers what he insists is only his personal opinion, lawless elements, vandals to blame. We glance at each other. Afterwards, someone asks our young Chinese guide if he agrees. His eyes cloud. He begins, as usual, a very difficult question. He looks behind him and, quick as a tossed grenade, blurts, "I was there." One of you has been going to Buddhist temples. We were talking before we began, and so this will be for Roger. It's called Vision at Taishan Mountain. Taishan is the holy mountain. Has steps, 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 steps. You can see them from this point beyond there, and people are toiling up there. Strange place. I'm doubtful, restless on this journey upward, with Buddhist pilgrims to Taishan, seeking whatever mountain covered with cloud can give. Here at the midway station, the summit's foot, Westerners gasp at miles of stairway carved into rock, a Tower of Babel, a Jacob's Ladder, spotted with toiling figures. For tourists, there's another way, a sky tram with rickety gondola packed and swaying across chasms toward the sacred peak beyond mist. I stay behind, feet wanting earth. Instead, I pace the road past booths of hawkers, then follow a path away from the crowd, looking for hummingbirds, five-leafed ginseng. Litter grows on the slopes, pecked by squawking magpies. The path leads to a hut on a cliff where two men carry a load of cabbages on a pole through a narrow door. They argue, go sideways, heads tumble and roll. I want to laugh, but there's too much that's human in it, earthbound like me, no place to turn. The long-tailed magpies soar into the abyss as I edge to trail's end, only to find a privy, foul as a harpy's nest. Back, the birds cry. I turn. Clouds break. The mountain flashes a mirror signal from a temple where saffron monks hum beyond all I know. Then mist moves over like a hand. The last section is called Looking for Grace, and I was really trying to finish this book, this China obsession I had. And I think I learned more with the last part than I did all the others, where I just more or less had to put down what I saw. And the last part I was thinking about, well, what does all this really mean for me? Why do I really care about this so much? So this is from a longer section called Deep Enough to Go Home. And I'll just read the first one called The Gift Mirror. My Chinese aunt, Grace, with her letters full of floods and famine and children stiffening under sycamores while missionaries carved their Sunday lamb, threw her Bible away and sent our family a gift, this mirror of amethyst and jade. Looking for her picture lost inside these attic boxes, I find instead myself staring out of the gift mirror, a missionary surrounded by grapes and leaves, asking, Who is this old girl? There really was a mirror, and it was a beautiful thing. It had the fox and the grapes, the fable by Aesop on it, which is strange because I didn't know the Chinese people knew about that, and I guess they did. And it's a marvelous representation of this fox and the grapes. And then this poem, I tried to write this several ways, and finally it just came out as a little prose thing, and then finally somehow it came together in a poem, and it's called Where It Hurts. In memory's interior eye, this old girl is new, a school child with white flower face, ready for Easter, shiny shoes tap dancing on cracks down a sidewalk, skirts twirling like a parasol, singing, mirror, mirror on the wall, let my father say I'm pretty, not you look like my sister Grace, that curse to make a daughter old as a Chinese aunt, flat photograph, always staring, gray as a church with closed doors, hiding something sinful. But she's ugly, the little girl cries with a false truth no little lady should tell. Her chest tightens as she gets into the family car, hugs herself in the back seat, ribs hurting from big sister's scornful elbow like that. Silent father sits at the wheel, never looks back. This old girl wants to jump out, but it's too late. Then love's brass looking glass goes dark. I'll finish this part with the last poem that kind of put it all together for me, and it's about this picture. You can look at it closer when you come up, if you do. It's cranes, and it's at night, and I bought this at a Chinese university after a demonstration of Chinese ink painting. But this one was different. It had a ghostly quality to it. It was not like all the others people were selling on the streets. And it put the book together for me at the end. For those who dream of cranes, after a painting by Song Feng Guang. The first one is Jinan, China. They wait for you at night in a thicket of bamboo. Snow falls around them. Their feathers rustle in light wind like secrets. They are talking about you. Beaks click like yellow knitting needles. Circle eyes pull you with invisible strings onto their ground to turn you into part of the ceremony. Watch how they bow, lift up long stick legs, set down feet as if casting small nets. Now they are calling, dancing, their feathered crests nod, white wings billow in moonlight. Then daybreak. You awake, alone, heavy, silence, a thicket, ghosts of cranes. Stonington, Michigan, where I live in the Upper Peninsula. In late August, near home, as the sun drops its red coin into a slot of black trees, sandhill cranes float down into the new mown hayfield, where they pace and strut, nearly tall as deer, dark gray, ghostly, making no sound as they feed, ready to leave for winter. Last spring, you heard them coming, a muttering beyond the lake like something small. Closer, they grew monstrous, voices loud as dry wood dropped in a box. They passed over, bound for their hidden nesting place. Tonight, you watch them again before they vanish tomorrow, coming, going, sure as the sun. 3. Jinan. Steel cranes lean over this city, piling up giant buildings where low brick houses with courtyards used to sprawl and tumble, where backyard fields of corn and cabbage reached toward the countryside. Now these great featherless birds haunt the new skyline, as if everything depended on height, concrete, money. Images of sacred cranes still grace the city pavement, the ancient pose. The artist at the university quickly brushes them in traditional form to help feed his family. But in this scroll, his favorite, painted slowly at night, cranes live as they should, forever. Number four, Janann Ann Stonington. In the thicket again, white cranes wait. You enter, empty-handed. From inside the puzzle of branches, you see vast plains where farmers cut corn stalks by hand. Hunched families drag rakes over dry soil to plant wheat for millions of mouths. You turn. Beyond bamboo, the hayfield near home, gray cranes feed in first light. They gather to fly over miles where bird-like machines worth armies of farmers eat corn. Wings pump high into cloud over cities already jagged with steel. Inside the maze, you learn the language, begin the ceremony. Gray brothers fly safely. White spirits speak. Well, I do write other things besides China poems. I think I've done the last of those. I'll just read one from this little chapbook, A Tree Between Us. It's more about the Upper Peninsula and the things that you see there. I will try the falls. Actually, this is about Minnesota, the falls is. We go to Quetico country that's near the Boundary Waters and near the edge of Minnesota and Canada. And it's kind of scary sometimes. I'm not real brave about the wilderness, but I go. The falls. On Roland Lake, a three-quarter moon throws a gray pall over black water. We fish silently from our canoe, thinking separate thoughts, hoping in this blank time and space to gather, to catch something big, maybe even strange, anything other than what we already know this time in our lives. Three quarters gone, lit only slightly by this chance to dabble in wilderness along with our grown children, who still explore the other side of the island. From our side, we can already hear the roar of Curtain Falls, wild white link between lakes called Crooked and Iron, where we go tomorrow. I sit invisible in the frail canoe, listening, imagining, then watching myself glide slowly over the top of a great rush of water, into a cauldron of moon-misted nothing. No more portaging, no more mosquitoes whining, mud sucking us in, only loose water covering everything. Just then I feel you shift your weight, tense your rod, get ready to reel in the usual mystery. A pop and splash, flick of silver near the boat tells us it's a bass. We've caught hundreds of them over the years, but it's better than nothing. This one's heavy, lively enough to end the night. I know you're smiling, even though I can't see you in the dark. I'm smiling too. We can go back to camp now, ready for sleep, the portage, the falls to come. This little piece thing, it's a little anthology, and it's from Duluth. There was a contest called the Lake Superior Writers, and it was a national contest, but you had to write about the North Woods, so that did limit it a bit. And I did win the poetry one, and I'll just read a short one from that. The Joy of Air. I'm a bird watcher, and there are a lot of them up there. There are a lot of them everywhere. People don't realize what's going on in the trees if you don't have the powerful glasses to see them. This is called The Joy of Air. If you walk with your eyes on the ground, look up at the tree swallows, how they sail between tree and telephone pole, swing over wide water, and catapult into cloud with zooms and twirls like blue angels, those Navy jet planes that famously fly over marveling clouds on the 4th of July. Between tricks, the birds cool on the wires, neat in shiny blue coats of swallowtail cut, with small chests barreled in white vests, flashing in sunlight, helmets on tight, a squad of cadets with pranks and chutzpah waiting in line for punishment or praise, building up avian steam for new ways to startle each other and us, a dogfight in midair that turns out to be sex. Then, as if to fix female to metaphor, they brood in the Martin house, poke their heads out like housefraus looking for rain, relief by husbands from nannying, a relay of birds as post-haste as racers. We reach for words that will capture them for us, give them to you, who seem too pedestrian to know what goes on in this world and in whatever heaven there is today or tomorrow. But tree swallows don't fit into cages, messages, telegrams. Birds will be birds. Look where they fling themselves. Now, up there. Well, we have time for a few questions if you have any. And I'm curious, where were you in China? Beijing. Beijing, the big city. Did you get to travel out and about some? Oh, okay, the Great Wall. Oh, and the first time we went there, there were no selling. There wasn't any tourist stuff going on. And then last time we went, it was like, buy this. Yes. Oh. Well, I do have one I've been working on. I seem to be into long poems tonight. Let's see. This one is about Tennessee. I've sort of left Tennessee out. I guess it was mentioned in the China poems, but this is called How to Find the Farm. And you know how you go back to the old house or the old place and you want to find just what you left there, and it's all different, and that feeling is very common. Well, this was a farm that I spent actually only one summer there, and it was right after World War II, and we lived out in the country, partly because my father liked the country and partly because we couldn't find a house in town. There was still a housing shortage. And I find that I just keep remembering that place over and over again. It was right in a river valley with mountains on both sides, very beautiful. How to find the farm. Go back to the farm you left in half light, wedged between mountain and river. Find the barn again, where the cow waited at dusk, fireflies rising up, up. See if the house they say burned down still stands white on the hilltop. Drive there now. Cross the new bridge. Look at the wide road, the crushed hill. What is left is nothing to remember. Red earth has forgotten you. Go back the only way you know. That's a short one for you. Any other thoughts? Well, thank you very much. Oh, she has another thought. Yes.
Well, you mentioned earlier that...
Well, again, I think I really saw so many things that divide us, as the title talks about, all that divides us, but I also saw a lot of things that brought us together. And again, families are always the common denominator. We have our parents and our children, and we have our friendships, and that's very true in either country. The other thing I learned, I think, think it became clearer to me, although I knew it academically, that the Chinese people have been dominated for so long by so many other countries that their desire to be their own people is very, very strong. And you can see that in this incident of the planes and this sort of thing. I think we have to remember how they were divided up into pieces like little pies by the Western countries back in the 19th century and on into the 20th century. And we have to, I think, understand that and respect it and not be quite so
touchy
about things. They're touchy and we're touchy, and maybe it's all just part of being human, but a little understanding goes a long way, I think. Yes.
What happened to your Chinese cousin?
Well, they're around. Some of them, the two older girls who were my age person, did die fairly early. One of them had had asthma and all kinds of things, and living in Tianjin, which is a big industrial city on the China Sea, It's on cold water and Gobi Desert and all this bad stuff, bad air. And she just couldn't make it after a while. Her breathing was so difficult. She had chronic bronchitis. The other one had cancer. And but my cousin Willie is in Vancouver. And he's he has created a program for people coming from either China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, coming to the West to work or to live. And he helps them understand our culture, does a great job. He has, in fact, with another cousin of mine who is not Chinese, who lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee, have written a book about Grace Divine Liu. That's a biography. It has letters and interviews and all kinds of fascinating things in her own voice. And it's available on Amazon.com. It was published by a small press in Alabama. It has pictures, and it's a big, heavy book. I didn't bring it because it would make my suitcase too heavy. But it's very interesting. It's called Grace in China. And it's by Eleanor Cooper and William Liu. Yes? Well, it gives me lots of material. They are very visual. I mean, to me, they are. They don't know that they're visual, I guess. But they're so, it's like a hidden world, it seems to me. This whole universe going on in the trees and the sky that most of us never really see unless you go out to see them purposely. And I guess I look at it as kind of like the stars and the trees and the wildflowers, and it's just a wonderful blessing that we have to be able to see them. I wonder what they think of us. I don't know. Do you watch birds? You better start. There's more of them than you'd think, but I don't know how long they're going to last. Yes.
What about poetry?
Not while I was there. In 80, they were still wanting or liking not so much the old wonderful things that all of our poets love to translate, but the more heroic, kind of obvious to us political sounding poems. And they don't do much for me, those don't, but they were popular at that time. Then after I left, actually about the time I was leaving, I was given a sheaf of poems by some newer poets, and I did do some translating. Now, I don't speak Chinese, but my cousin, of course, conveniently does. He is totally bilingual, just understands both perfectly. And so he would tell me the literal meaning, and I would translate them. And those were called at the time the poets of a wound, the wound poets, meaning that they were talking about the ills of the Cultural Revolution. And they were expressing themselves much more personally and perhaps romantically, and they were criticized to some degree, but I think now, of course, many have come to the U.S., and we know a lot of, well, several poets who are here now, living here, and writing. Bao Dai is the one I know, or Bei Dao, I believe it's pronounced. I haven't really studied the poetry all that closely, but I'm sure the imagistic quality is still there, which is what we got through Pound and back to Du Fu and all those good people that were so very chiseled and imagistic. I'm not an expert on Chinese poetry, but... Right. Well, Mandarin, I guess, is what, I don't speak it, but, you know, what we worked with. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of influence, I think, on our poets from the Chinese classic poets, not so much the newer ones. Well, I've enjoyed this very much, yes. Oh, my goodness. That one hurts. I will if you insist. No, I will. I have not read this out loud because it admits a lot of, you know, it's our, okay. I'm missing in China. And this is about trying to bring all of this turmoil about China and my family and my father and all of this into some kind of focus. And I used the villanelle. I found out sometimes if you use a form with some kind of very disturbing material that you just can't get a handle on, it helps to force it into some kind of form. Missing in China. Sudden moonlight steals my father from me. These nightly visions of his death must end. Another woman lies down in my place, awake. She wears a copy of my face. Her skin is torn, a scar she could not mend. Her open eyelids steal my father from me with foreign dreams suggesting prophecy, a lonely death some distant god might send. A jealous woman lies awake in place of daughter's innocence. Buried memory weaves a rope from silken dresses, blends flags and flowers, steals my father from me. As I dream a death I would not hope to see, except that life itself decrees an end. Again, his sister rises in my place, the one who left her brother without grace. Her missing face is mine. My dreams pretend a foreign country stole my father from me. A jealous child is waking in my place. Thank you. Thank you all for coming and sitting.